Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On July 18th, Detroit became the largest municipality in U.S. history to file for bankruptcy. Kevin Orr, the appointed emergency manager, says the city's debt is between $18 and $20 billion. Since January 2010, 36 municipalities in the U.S. have filed for bankruptcy, but many argue that Detroit is a cautionary tale for what might be in store for even more cities. Detroit, once the fourth largest city in the country, has gone through a major population decline. The city's population has declined from a 1950 high of 1.8 million to 700,000 today, with tens of thousands of abandoned buildings, vacant lots, and unlit streets. According to the Financial Times, Detroit, once the heart of the U.S. auto industry, has also lost about 80% of its manufacturing base since 1972. So on today's Your Call, we are going to be talking about the bankruptcy and what it means to those of us who don't live there. What is its relevance? What do we need to know about Detroit besides its devastated landscape, social services, and dire financial situation? Today, we're joined by Brent Snavely. He's a business reporter at the Detroit Free Press, where he's been covering Detroit's bankruptcy. And the Detroit Free Press recently launched a new feature called Searching for the Truth about Detroit, because there's so much misinformation out there. Hi, Brent. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how you doing? And thanks for having me on.
Good, and thanks for joining us. We're also joined by Jay Wall Jasper. He's a senior fellow at the Project for Public Spaces, a fellow at On the Commons, and editor-at-large of Ode Magazine. His new book is called All That We Share, A Field Guide to the Commons. And Jay joins us from Minneapolis.
Hello.
Hi, Jay. Welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Nice to have you. So, Brent, let's start off with you. First of all, this got so much attention when it was announced, international attention. Where are we now? I mean, what are people talking about today?
Well, so last week was the first bankruptcy hearing, and this week there'll be another hearing on Friday. And so where we're at this point is, you know, there were some challenges to Detroit's ability to file for Chapter 9 bankruptcy, and those challenges came in the way of some other lawsuits filed in other state courts, and the bankruptcy judge, Judge Rhodes, essentially dismissed or put a stay on those lawsuits, saying that the right place to for those debates is in bankruptcy court. However, those challenges aren't done, and Detroit still must go through what's called an eligibility phase. It still must qualify under the judge's opinion to file for bankruptcy, even though it is now in bankruptcy protection. And that argument and those debates will play out over the next probably 1 to 2 months.
Okay, so we saw the headlines and everyone said, what happened and how did this happen? So can you give us some background information? What do we need to know about this bankruptcy and how it happened?
Sure, and you covered some of it in your introduction there. Detroit is very unusual in some ways. In terms of if you compare it to other municipal bankruptcies, most other municipal bankruptcies, Orange County in the 90s, Jefferson County in recent years, Jefferson County, Alabama, those bankruptcies were largely precipitated by one major cause. Detroit, there are at least a half dozen major factors that have occurred over a period of decades that led to this situation. You mentioned the population decline. You also mentioned the manufacturing job decline. Detroit, or Metro Detroit, is still the capital of the auto industry for the Detroit 3. A lot of people don't realize that Chrysler is based in the suburbs, has one plant, two plants in the city. Ford is based in Dearborn, which is a suburb of Detroit. And then there's been, let's face it, some bad policy, some bad management, and some corruption that did not help. And I could go on.
Yeah. Well, and right. And so we'll talk about that because it's really important to talk about the details. And Jay, why don't you jump in here?
Absolutely.
What are your thoughts about, you know, what we need to know about why this happened?
Well, the first thing, I'm offering the outside perspective. I don't live in Detroit. I actually live in Minnesota. But I was working in Detroit for about a year on a project at Wayne State University that brought in a bunch of fellows from around the country that were there to kind of help boost what was happening in Detroit. So, and again, I, like the typical American, you know, had a pretty dim view of Detroit when I went in. And I thought, you know, is this work going to be any fun at all? And when I got there, I kind of caught the fever. I understand with all the problems that Detroit has, why many, many people there are still very invested in that city. You know, it is such a, it's such an industrial landmark in American life, but also there, you know, there's a lot of on the grassroots level. I mean, the municipal government obviously is very hard hit, and there's been disinvestment in Detroit going back, you know, really. Well, I think the riots in 67 were the thing that catalyzed a lot of people leaving the city. I study cities a lot as a journalist, and it's interesting because Detroit is, I think there was an ethic in Detroit that, you know, it didn't really matter what happened in the center city. You know, so long as the things were still good in the surrounding suburbs, then Detroit would be fine. But I think we're discovering you can't really say, you know, hey, my lungs are good, my legs are good, you know, my hairline is good. Yeah, my heart's no good, but I'm still fundamentally healthy because, you know, metropolitan regions are organic wholes. So a region cannot thrive when the kind of the center city of it is really declining. And I think people are beginning, you know, in Detroit and else around the country to figure that out.
And I would like to invite or welcome Thomas Sugrue to the show. Thomas is professor of history and sociology at the University of Pennsylvania. He's author of a number of books, including The Origins of the Urban Crisis, Race and Inequality in Postwar Detroit. He's got a piece in The New Yorker called The Rise and Fall of Detroit's Middle Class. And Thomas grew up in Detroit. Hi, Tom. Welcome to the show.
Hi, it's great to be here.
It's great to have you. So, I mean, we're going to talk about a lot of the misconceptions. This is one of the reasons why Detroit Free Press launched the Truth About Detroit feature. But first off, I mean, you grew up in Detroit. You know, what were your thoughts when you heard that the city filed for bankruptcy?
Well, I think the crisis has been long in coming, but as a native Detroiter, I have to say I found it profoundly sad. It's the culmination of decades worth of disinvestment, of mismanagement, the failure of federal and state policies, and any one of these would have been problematic for a city like Detroit, but all three of them occurred simultaneously, interacted with each other, and really put Detroit in the extraordinarily precarious financial position that we find it in today.
And Brent, the appointed emergency manager, Kevin Orr, says Detroit's debt is between $18 and $20 billion.
Yeah. There have, prior to the bankruptcy, there were a lot of people that sort of challenged some of those numbers. But whether it's $18 billion or $20 billion or $12 billion, it is still just a mammoth, mammoth problem. And it got to a point where the governor and the emergency manager, you know, had to make a decision, and the decision was, I mean, you cannot tinker with Detroit anymore and expect a recovery. You need to do something pretty dramatic, and the emergency manager attempted to negotiate some deals outside of the bankruptcy process, and ultimately he made the decision that in his view, those negotiations weren't working, and that led to the bankruptcy.
And how are the people responding to this? Because there have been protests in front of the U.S. District Courthouse in Detroit, especially by city workers, because their pensions are in danger.
Yeah, you know, I got to be honest with you that the city workers and unions and retirees have been protesting in the neighborhoods, and I live in the city myself. You know, it's sad and people are talking about it. It's the topic of the day, but life hasn't changed, really. This was a long, slow decline to this point. City services are not very great. I've had some positive experiences personally, but overall, you know, city services are not serving the people very well. And, you know, and we're only 2 weeks into this, but city services haven't declined in any noticeable way, and nor have they improved in any noticeable way. And I'd say life is normal in Detroit.
So you're saying they weren't very good even before the
right
official filing came?
Right.
What is the mood like? I mean, for people who live there, what do they think is in store for their future?
I think there's a lot of misconceptions and questions about the bankruptcy process and what it means and what it could mean. I am actually, you said I'm a business reporter, and I am, and I'm an automotive reporter. I've lived through the restructurings of Chrysler and General Motors, which was a very scary day, just as scary for this region as Detroit's bankruptcy is, when those companies filed for bankruptcy, and yet they came out stronger, and 2-3 years later, they're much better off financially. Now, the one key thing, and this has received a lot of attention, one key difference that allowed Chrysler and GM to get out of bankruptcy were federal loans, and clearly there is no political will for state or federal aid for the city of Detroit. So, another big topic that is being examined and will continue to be examined is, once the city does restructure its balance sheet and debts, then what? Will the city fundamentally be different, and will there be a new revenue stream? And really, the only way to answer that is to make it a more attractive place for more people to live and more businesses to locate.
And before we let you go, since your paper launched a new feature called Searching for the Truth About Detroit, Greg Gardner's lead is suddenly everyone's a Detroit expert, whether he or she has ever been here. Greedy unions, decades of neglect, too much government, not enough government, overdependence on the auto industry. There's probably someone who's blamed the bankruptcy on bad pizza. Mm-hmm. Basically saying that there's so much information out there, a lot of it is wrong. What really strikes you about the media coverage of this?
Well, one of the things we've talked about, and I'll try to mention two things here quickly. Maybe really three things. Most of the mainstream national coverage has been pretty intelligent about a lot of the reasons. We as reporters appearing on shows like this, we do get a lot of questions like, well, isn't the auto industry rebounding? Doesn't that help the city? And it does, and it is. But as I mentioned earlier, Ford is actually not based inside of Detroit, nor is Chrysler. And so as those companies get healthier and rebound, it's not Detroit's savior anymore. The other thing, you talked about the population decline, and that's been well covered. Detroit is still one of the largest cities geographically in the United States, 142 square miles. And if you think about that financially, it has an infrastructure built for 2 million people in the 1950s, which now serves 700,000 people. And you're struggling to create a tax base to generate enough revenue to serve an infrastructure that was built for a city of twice its population. And that is fundamentally a very scary and very difficult management issue for even the most talented politicians and city managers.
Well, it is interesting to look at the media coverage, and we'd love to have you back, Brent, on one of our Friday shows to discuss how the media are covering this issue. So thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, no problem.
Thank you. That's Brent Snavely. He's a business reporter at the Detroit Free Press, where he's been covering the bankruptcy, and they just launched a new feature called Searching for the Truth About Detroit. And we are talking today about the bankruptcy that was announced on July 18th. Kevin Orr, the appointed emergency manager, says Detroit's debt is between $18 and $20 billion. So what questions do you have about this? And what does it tell us about what might be in store for more cities? What does it say about the future of this country? And if you'd like to know about how this is relevant to you, we'll talk about that also today. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We're joined today by Jay Waljasper, Senior Fellow at the Project for Public Spaces. His new book is All That We Share, A Field Guide to the Commons. Thomas Segrew is Professor of History and Sociology at the University of Pennsylvania. His latest book is The Origins of the Urban Crisis, Race and Inequality in Postwar Detroit. He grew up in Detroit. And Tom, what are your thoughts on how this is being covered? What are some misconceptions out there that you're seeing, and what do you think needs more attention?
Well, I think one of the biggest misconceptions has to do with the relationship of public employees and their unions to Detroit's bankruptcy, not necessarily in the responsible press, but online, on blogs, and in some of the right-leaning media. The argument is essentially these vampire-like public employees sucked the city dry and bear responsibility for driving Detroit into the budget crisis. And their pensions and their health benefits in particular, the argument goes, are responsible for many of Detroit's woes. And it's true that the pension is, and pension obligations are a pretty significant part of Detroit's debt, but we have to look at the reality of how pensions, what pensions look like for Detroit City employees. The average pension for a municipal, retired municipal worker in Detroit is about $19,000 a year. For police and firefighters who had a more generous pension plan, their annual pensions in the low 30s, and many of them don't have Social Security because they didn't pay into it as public employees. Mm-hmm. And so we're not talking about a bunch of bloated former city employees who are living high off the hog while the city goes down. We're talking about people who are living in modest comfort at best off of the city pensions that they worked for a good part of their careers.
And you wrote about this in your New Yorker piece, and it's getting some attention that, that these benefits are lower than places like Dallas, Texas, for example. As you said, the average pension is less than 20 grand a year.
That's right. And so when we look at how we're going to ask Detroiters and the financial institutions that are holding the municipal bonds and the debt of the city, we have to balance two sides. On one side, we have public employees and retirees who aren't making very much, who are going to be asked to take a pretty big cut in those pensions and in those health benefits. On the other side, we've got municipal bondholders who took a risk in investing in, as all bondholders and bankers do, and they're going to have to take a haircut from the obligations that the city owes. And to a great extent, over the next year and a half, 2 years, however long this is battled out in the courts, there's going to be a struggle between those representing pensioners and city employees on one side and those representing municipal bondholders and banks on the other.
So if we're still trying to figure out why this happened, I mean, luckily we don't have to talk in sound bites on this show, but the fact is you do in most media. And again, going back to this, the truth about Detroit, there's too much government. Some people say it's not enough government. This is what happens when you have Democrats in office for so many decades. I mean, how would you explain exactly why this happened?
This is a long process. There's no one single villain who plays out in the story of Detroit's financial collapse. It begins in the 1950s with steady disinvestment from the city by major stakeholders, by corporations, by the auto industry, by the retail sector. They rapidly suburbanize. Detroit's a 20th century city, and people are getting in their cars and moving further and further out, and jobs and money are following. In addition, Detroit is a city of very tense racial politics and a lot of racial division. Again, beginning in the 40s and 1950s, there was massive white flight to the suburbs. It began way before the riot of 1967. And that white flight took away money and also led to the decline in property values in the city. Now, a city relies on taxes from its employers, from people who work there, and from property holders, and that tax base pretty steadily diminished beginning in the middle of the 20th century right up to the present day. At the same time, the city had to deal with maintaining municipal services, providing social services to an increasingly poor and working class population, maintaining its aging infrastructure, and continuing to provide safety and the other services that residents of any city depend on. And the vast size of Detroit, as Mr. Snavely pointed out, ended up complicating things a great deal because Detroit's a city built for 2 million people, and today it has roughly 700,000. So you've got all these factors playing out together. And then you throw in the next big factor, which is beginning in the 1960s, especially in the 1970s and 80s, the federal and state governments steadily withdrew support for big cities, not just Detroit, but all over the country. And that withdrawal meant that cities were left more and more to fend for themselves with fewer and fewer resources. And so Democratic and Republican elected officials, particularly on the state level and on the federal level, bear as much responsibility for Detroit's financial woes as do the mayors and city council people in Detroit. It's a bipartisan problem with bipartisan origins, not simply with Democratic origins, as some in the blogosphere would want us to believe.
And Jay, what else would you add to that?
Well, you know, the word disinvestment has been used a lot, and it's interesting. One of the things that is in Detroit's history and many, many communities is redlining. You know, for a long time, it was, you know, banks were actually almost not allowed to give a loan if there were too many people of color or too many poor people in the neighborhood. So, I mean, that's had a devastating effect on many cities, but Detroit, I think, most of all. Also, you know, and Brent was right to point out, you know, there were 2 million people in 1950, and there are, you know, 700,000 now, and those people are by and large pretty poor. When you have a concentration of poverty like that, you're inevitably going to have really severe problems. Now, in California, I think there's a number of cities that have filed for bankruptcy. They actually weren't central cities. They were suburbs, but suburbs with low income and, you know, and a high proportion of people of color. So that when, you know, if so long as we continue to sort of cluster poor people in one area, then of course the tax base isn't not going to be strong enough to support those basic services without money coming from the state and the federal government.
Well, let's hear from a caller who worked in Detroit. Let's go to Rob in Richmond. Hi, Rob. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi. This is a really, it's both a professional and personal thing, because I do a lot of art stuff in Detroit, and I'm a professor in Ann Arbor doing a spatial geography of violence in Flint and Detroit. And I think Chris Hedges gets it right. These are sacrifice zones, and we need a United States internal Marshall Plan, because these are like slow motion Katrinas, and Detroit can't come back based on regional or local kinds of initiatives. These are large-scale industrial rust belt problems, and it's happening to a greater or lesser extent throughout the region. And just to be clear, Detroit is number two now as the most violent city in the country, and Flint is number one. And they teeter back and forth. Oakland's number four, so let's. And Point Richmond is dealing with it better. I mean, Richmond. I'm living in Point Richmond too. But anyway, the point is that I don't think we can deal with these issues at the local or state level, because otherwise, you know, they're so large scale. Just destroying or taking down all the abandoned buildings in Detroit would cost billions of dollars at this point. Anyways, I just wanted to put that out there. It's a really large problem, and I think that this is a wake-up call, I hope. And in fact, I totally agree that this is going to affect really poor people. I mean, Detroit is 85% black, and that's a marker for that's just a marker at this point for really poor people that can't leave or don't want to leave for whatever historical reasons. But the rest of Michigan is 7% on average white. The national average is 12%. All the major cities in Michigan are majority black. And so these are effectively becoming, points of concentration of poverty, and they can't get out of it. Mm. And that's why I call it a slow motion Katrina.
Yeah, thank you so much. I mean, the official unemployment rate in Detroit is 16%. And as you said, incredibly high poverty rate. And according to Vice, as you said, the highest murder capital in the world. And it takes about 58 minutes for the cops to arrive. And we'll continue this discussion right after a break.
Many ways to join in today's conversation on Your Call on the phone, via email, or on our website, yourcallradio.org. The phone number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK, or send an email question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll talk about the legal ramifications of the most recent Supreme Court rulings on generic drugs. If you take drugs, especially generic ones, you'll want to tune in tomorrow. One of the cases we'll be talking about involves brand name companies paying competitors to delay the introduction of cheaper versions of drugs. And then the other one, we mentioned this on a recent show about Supreme Court rulings, shields manufacturers from liability for defective medicine. So what do these rulings mean for those of us who take generic drugs, and what role will the FDA play here? That's tomorrow. And then coming up on Wednesday, we will have a conversation about what should be done with the Delta Water Plan. And then we're also going to talk about water conservation. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the bankruptcy in Detroit. Filed on July 18th. It's getting international headlines, and there's a lot of misinformation out there. So we're talking about why this actually happened. What does this mean? What is its relevance to those of us who do not live in Detroit? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Thomas Segrue, professor of history and sociology at the University of Pennsylvania. He grew up in Detroit. His latest book is The Origins of the Urban Crisis, Race and Inequality in Postwar Detroit. J. Walt Jasper is a senior fellow at Project for Public Spaces. His new book is All That We Share, A Field Guide to the Commons. And he's a fellow at On the Commons and editor-at-large of Ode Magazine. So, Jay, why don't you respond to our last caller who works in Detroit, Rob. I mean, there's a lot he brought up there. I mean, the child poverty rate in Detroit is 60%. Yeah. He believes that this is actually going to have a ripple effect. Do you agree with that?
Well, in some ways, I think Detroit is more anomalous now than it once was. At one time, you could throw Detroit into a basket that also included Cleveland, also included Milwaukee, also included a lot of post-industrial cities. But I think Detroit has had bigger problems to grapple with. Actually, Cleveland, which is a lot of people, you know, often spoke in the same breath, Cleveland and Detroit. You know, Cleveland is, you know, clearly they have still big problems there. But they're turning things around, and there's a lot of things that are happening there. You know, a lot of the cities now that you hear about as being the really tough luck cities, Camden, New Jersey, East St. Louis, Illinois, actually are not the biggest city in their metro region. Interesting, I think in 2011 was the first year since probably about 1920 that American center cities actually gained population at a greater rate than the suburbs did. So there's a lot of dynamics that are sort of changing urban America today, and it may well be inner ring suburbs and blue collar suburbs that are kind of the Detroits of tomorrow. That doesn't, you know, that's cold comfort for Detroit right now to say, well, you're one of the few cities, center cities, that's dealing with this in such a big way. Also, interesting things are happening, you know, just demographically. I think of the largest metro, the 20 largest metro areas in the country, I think 13 of them actually saw their white populations increase between 2000 and 2010. So there's just a lot of things happening. You know, cities are sort of hot right now, you know, for young people particularly. So that's changing the dynamics, and that offers some hope for all these, you know, concentration of poverty issues and things like that. But Detroit, you know, things, you know, there's a lot of heartbreak stories in that city, but there's also good things that are happening. There's a couple neighborhoods downtown and the Midtown neighborhood that are actually, there's a housing crisis in Midtown because it's become a very popular place to live around Wayne State University. There's a lot of medical things going on there. Downtown, just some interesting places. That doesn't help everybody in the entire city, but at least it's kind of a foothold that not everything in Detroit's going downhill.
Do you agree with that, Tom? What are your thoughts about Jay saying that there are some good things happening also in Detroit?
Well, I think my take on Detroit and on many other cities, especially the big industrial cities of the Northeast and Midwest, would be more pessimistic than Jay's. Detroit has attracted hipsters, artists, in part because it's really cheap right now. You can pick up a house in Detroit, a single-family detached house for, you know, somewhere between $15,000 and $30,000, which means the startup costs are incredibly low. On the other hand, there's kind of a messianic fervor that, you know, this influx of, you know, about maybe 5,000 into the Midtown area is somehow going to have a ripple effect throughout the metropolitan area. And really for the last 30, 40 years, one of the main targets of urban policy has been gentrification, attracting cultural producers in, on the assumption that the benefits of their presence are somehow going to trickle down to surrounding neighborhoods and to the rest of the city. And look, when I go to Detroit now, and I go there pretty frequently, there are more interesting coffee shops, restaurants, bars, art galleries, places for me to spend time and spend my money than there were 10 or 20 years ago. But the situation, once you get away from those little enclaves in the remainder of the city, is incredibly bleak. Mm. And ultimately, I think we need to judge the success or failure of our urban policy not on attracting, you know, a couple percentage points more whites into central cities, but rather what's happening in the poor and working class and lower middle class neighborhoods that are, that house the majority of residents of these big cities, including Detroit, but also Philadelphia, Cleveland, Chicago, et cetera.
Well, yeah, and that's, Robert Reich has a column out, a former labor secretary under President Clinton, saying that the social contract is broken, and that's what we really need to focus on. He says that it's a failure of political negotiations over how financial sacrifices should be divided among the city's creditors, workers, and retirees. But there's a more basic story here. It's being replicated across the country. Americans are segregating by income more than ever before, which means that if you're wealthy in America, you don't have to come across anyone who isn't. And he says this is one of the big problems. You've got high crime, dilapidated parks, terrible schools in predominantly poor areas. What are your thoughts on that, Tom, that that's the real story here?
It's absolutely a real story, and the data on this are really grim. Sean Reardon, who's a sociologist and education specialist at Stanford, has recently done a really detailed study of socioeconomic segregation in metropolitan areas and finds that it's increasing all over the United States. And that spatial difference, that separation of people with means and poor and working class people, has an impact on access to services, it has an impact on education, it has an impact on quality of life, and it furthers that us versus them mentality that is behind a lot of the public policies that have disadvantaged cities in recent years. In Michigan, you know, the prevailing wisdom outside of Detroit is it's their problem, it's not my problem. People in Detroit are going to pick my pocket and squander our hard-earned tax dollars. There's not a sense of common ground. Mm-hmm. Although, as Joy points out, it may be that over time, as many of these inner-ring suburbs, especially the working-class suburbs, begin to face some of the problems of big cities, that we'll start to see those city-suburban alliances metamorphose. And we're starting to see a little bit in some metros around the country now.
Is this unique to Detroit, or do you think that this will spread across the country, Tom?
I think the socioeconomic segregation, is that what you're asking?
Well, that's definitely not unique, but
yeah.
The bankruptcy and just how horrible the situation has become.
Yeah, you know, cities have a lot of reasons to keep from going into bankruptcy, and there's a lot of political, there's not very much political will for sending other places taking the path of Detroit. That said, many other big cities right now are facing serious problems with their pensions, and they're watching Detroit very closely. Many big city school districts, Chicago, Philadelphia, just to name two, and cities that on the face of it seem healthier than Detroit in lots of ways, they're suffering serious budget deficits and having to make really hard cuts, closing schools, firing teachers, reducing, you know, increasing class sizes and the like. So the problems that Detroit's are facing, I think, are an extreme case, but they are playing out to one degree or another in a lot of the big cities around the country right now.
Jay, how relevant is this to those of us who don't live there?
Well, I think that I'm not sure we're going to see a rash of bankruptcies of major metropolitan cities, but I do think that we still live under a no new taxes sort of a sword hanging over our head. Politicians are very, very, very reluctant to raise taxes. And if you don't raise taxes, you have to start slashing public services. And that can have a huge effect on a city when suddenly You know, public benefits go down. The libraries are shut down. You know, transit fares go up. You know, just across the board, you know, municipal utilities go up. And so a lot of cities, I think, are going to be facing some of the same questions about Detroit, where to cut. And unfortunately, you know, this sort of climate that, you know, we just simply can't raise taxes anymore it's really hard for communities of any sort, including suburban communities, sometimes to get ahead. When the public services decline, the quality of life declines, and then people, you know, vote with their feet and say, we don't want to live there.
And can you just describe what it looks like? Because you wrote about your recent trip to Detroit. You write, a society rooted a sense of the commons would not foster such disparities. Public services, social responsibilities, and local tax revenues would be shared by the whole region. No community would be allowed to sink into such decline, but that is not the society we live in today. You write, the basic realities of everyday life differ greatly depending on which side of a municipal boundary you reside.
Yeah, but visiting Detroit can be quite shocking. And when I was first visited there, some people took me to the Grosse Pointe Park, Detroit boundary on Kershaville Street. And it was just amazing. I mean, it was night and day. On the Detroit side of things, you know, mostly empty lots where buildings had once been and were left. You saw thrift stores, and if there were any businesses at all, most of them were empty. And then suddenly you cross this imaginary boundary, and it's a beautiful, you know, the tree line. There's trees on the streets. You know, there's cafes. I mean, it is really quite shocking that kind of disparity can exist just because of an abstract political boundary. And across the country, you know, the idea of the commons, you know, that there are things that belong to all of us, is something that really matters. Now, a city that I have studied very closely through the years has been Copenhagen, Denmark. You know, and Copenhagen, it's a lovely city, but they had a very, you know, a lot of inner city poverty there. And basically, they had a system where essentially wealthier suburbs kicked in money to help the inner city and help poorer suburbs. And that has really kind of kept things even keel. And I think in the end, everyone benefits from that, because the people that live in swank Detroit suburbs, you know, are not benefiting, are not prospering when the inner city goes down the tubes. I mean, that's kind of been proven over and over and over. It's a myth that you can essentially secede in a metropolitan region and not feel some effects for it.
That is Jay Waljasper, senior fellow at the Project for Public Spaces. His new book is All That We Share, A Field Guide to the Commons. Thomas Segrue is professor of history and sociology at the University of Pennsylvania. He has a piece in The New Yorker called The Rise and Fall of Detroit's Middle Class. He grew up in Detroit. His latest book is The Origins of the Urban Crisis, Race and Inequality in Postwar Detroit. And we have full lines. We'll get to calls in just a minute. We'll have one open in a few minutes at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Al in Oakland. Hi, Al.
I actually had a question on something else, but while you're on the subject of wealthier suburbs helping out, we have kind of a black hole in the middle of Oakland known as Piedmont. And I was at a number of Safe Oakland meetings with various researchers from around the country, academics, and none of them brought up that simple fact. This is just an aside. My question for your guests concerns getting some statistics on all this stuff, like, you know about the flight, because it went down from 2 million, excuse me, to 700,000 population. But the industries that left and where they went to, and also the decline of the U.S. auto industry, and what that might have had to do with planned obsolescence at a certain point, because U.S. cars got a very bad reputation, and the Japanese did come across with small cars that were reliable at the time. And I don't have any statistics. I'm wondering in particular about the planned obsolescence issue, and what's actually known about that as a policy of the auto industry.
All right, thank you. Thomas, do you want to take that?
Yeah, definitely. It's part of my book. So Detroit was affected profoundly by the restructuring of the auto industry, which began well before Japanese and European competition in the industry. The auto industry moved out of Detroit beginning in the post-war years, especially the 1950s, to other parts of the United States, and then in the 1970s to other parts of the world. They were in search of less expensive labor, states began competing with each other over tax benefits to lure companies in, and increasingly they began to move overseas in search of new markets, but also in search of places like, say, the Maquiladora region along the Mexican border, where there were fewer environmental and labor regulations. And so Detroit was devastated by that. Today, Detroit doesn't have very much, by the way, of auto industry employment. Chrysler and General Motors, which are the two big auto employers in the city, only have about 4,000 workers each. And there, depending on how you count, there's one or two auto plants within the boundaries of the city of Detroit right now. One's actually kind of half in a suburb, half in the city. The other's wholly in the city. And that's it. So while if you look at Detroit's history, the auto industry's disinvestment played a crucial role in devastating the city's employment and tax base. Today, it's not by any means the most important player. Ironically, right, especially for the story of bankruptcy, public employment is the core of the city's economy, followed by hospitals. Detroit relies heavily on those public sector and heavily public contracted or publicly funded jobs today. And I think that's one place where we're going to see potentially devastating impacts of the bankruptcy and of economic restructuring, which is the disappearance of jobs that were in some ways the only thing that has kept Detroit afloat since the auto industry left.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, Al. Let's go next to Dan in Santa Cruz. Hi, Dan. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I'm in Santa Cruz here for work, but I actually live in Michigan, born and raised in Michigan.
Oh.
I grew up in Lansing, but I live and work in Grand Rapids and do some work in Detroit. And so I'm familiar with the conditions in the state. And what motivated my call is one of the guests on the show said that this needs to be a national issue, you know, for Flint and Detroit, that it's too big for the local communities to handle. But in Michigan, you've got a huge diversity. In Grand Rapids, there are cranes on the skyline all the time. And I am just convinced that subsidiarity is the most important key to the success of Detroit and Flint, not the federal government. God forbid that they get involved in this. Because Grand Rapids has been driven by something called the Grand Action Plan, where people say, what do we want to have here? What do we want to build? We brought in this medical mile that we've got. And it's driven primarily by private industry and people on the ground. And I think, well, Detroit should not look to the federal government for the answer. They should say, what do we want here? You know, the idea of rural farming has been discussed. Tear some of those down. It could become a new revolutionary idea of inner city farming. And for me, I just think that the local aspect can get away from the government. Look to the private industry and private organizations to say, what do we want Detroit to look like? And stay away from federal answers unless they serve on the ground what people are asking for. I'm curious what people might
That's also a question, is what are the people asking for? Jay, what are your thoughts about the federal government's role in this? And who should get involved here?
Yeah, when you look at $18 or $20 billion, I mean, it's going to be really hard to fight your way back from that without a helping hand somewhere. But having said that, I also do think that one of the things that really struck me when I started visiting Detroit really frequently was that despite all the devastation there, there was really quite a wealth of civic organizations, groups, you know, nonprofit organizations, citizens groups, and things like that were working on various aspects of the city to try to, whether it was the schools or whether it was CDC, community development corporations in various neighborhoods. But there really, people hadn't given up. There was a really lot going on. So I think somehow, you know, getting resources to those organizations, whether it's from the federal government, whether it's through philanthropy, and there's a lot of philanthropy in Detroit still. I mean, the Kresge Foundation, the Skillman Foundation, the Ford Foundation, you know, they're involved there. I mean, so I think it takes everybody, kind of all hands on deck.
Thomas, what are your thoughts on this? The Detroit Free Press is reporting that, this is not surprising, but Republicans are pushing measures to prevent federal bailouts for Detroit. I mean, they will not budge on this issue. And how do you think, what are your thoughts on that, and what role should the federal government play?
Well, as Jay pointed out, it's going to be very difficult for Detroit to generate the revenue internally to take care of $18 to $20 billion. Some of it will be saved in haircuts to the municipal bondholders and pension cuts. But without an infusion of external money, Detroit's going to continue to face a lot of serious problems. And look, I think Jay is right, too, about the vitality of the civic infrastructure in Detroit. There are a lot of really great people doing very interesting work in the city. But alone, they don't have the scale or capacity to solve the city's problems. And look, I mean, the federal government plays a very important role in creating employment in Grand Rapids, in Detroit, in many other big cities. The hospital mile in Grand Rapids is there in large part because hospitals rely heavily on federal support through Medicare and Medicaid, especially in big metropolitan areas, but all sorts of other monies that come from the state and federal government to generate those jobs and to provide those services to citizens. And so the federal government's there. It's played an important role in the past, and it's played a really critical role in Detroit and elsewhere in devastating the city, too. Interstate highways, subsidies to suburbanization through housing programs, all of these played a negative role. So in some ways, I think it's important, and there's not very much political will for it, but important to think about solving the city's problems, not just from within, but also getting support from stakeholders at the state and federal level.
What about the people who are just trying to get by? There was a good piece in the Washington Post about people who stand in line at job placement offices for 4 or 5 hours a day, and the only thing they can find is operating a forklift for $8 to $9 an hour. I mean, these are people in their 40s and 50s who did some work in the auto industry and now really have not many options.
It's really hard. And in metropolitan Detroit, which has an abysmal public transit system, it's very hard for city residents to get access to reliable transportation to go 25, 30, 45 miles out from the city, which is where what little job growth has been happening in Michigan in the last 10 years has been happening. And so, again, that's an area where public policy has to step in. We have a huge gap because of segregation in the housing market from where people live and where the most significant job opportunities are being created.
What are your thoughts, Jay, just quickly on the climate we're in right now? Anti-government, anti-tax, anti-public sector. So much of the media coverage is focusing on public sector workers, even though the average wage pension is about $20,000 a year. How will this affect the recovery of Detroit?
Well, we often, at this era in American life, look to the individualistic solution. But when you have a problem like Detroit, it's not just simply going to be, you know, entrepreneurs are great, but they can't take a problem, you know, turn around a ship like that. There's a lot of other things that need to be done. And I think this is across all issues and across all communities. We need to kind of rediscover a sense of collaboration, a sense of cooperation, a sense that we're all in this together. That's the idea of the commons, the sense of the we. I mean, so that's a psychic change that's going on. You know, and one thing I was just going to, in this conversation, no one's talked about yet that, you know, New York City faced near bankruptcy in the 1970s. And the federal government refused to help them. And, you know, New York did come back. I mean, so there is an example of a city that looks pretty far gone. It was everybody's definition of dysfunction at that point. And now New York is, you know, a world capital of finance, commerce, and everything else.
We have an email from Rob Lipton, who works in a Department of Emergency Medicine at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. He says that there is a terrible infrastructure in Michigan and Detroit specifically. Lousy roads, no public transportation, relatively few good universities. The car manufacturers treated Michigan as a large gold mine, only developing what they needed to produce cars. The lack of infrastructure makes Michigan different and worse and sad. Well, thank you for that email, Rob. Let's go. We have time for one more caller. Let's hear from George in San Francisco. Hi, George.
Well, you know, I hope I was listening with both ears, because it seems to us as we listen to this that there's another prospective element to the formula you're working on about what happened to cities, Detroit being the example this morning, and that is how much of this correlates with the crazy gerrymandering that we've been noticing.
Tom, gerrymandering, does that play a role here?
Gerrymandering definitely plays a role. Political power is a crucial part of the story, and Detroit and other big cities have lost political clout in their state capitals and in Congress. It's not just gerrymandering, it's also population loss. I mean, with 700,000 people, Detroit essentially has a single congressional district at this point. There's a little bit of more than one in there, but we're talking about a city that used to have a pretty significant clout in the state and federal capitals and doesn't anymore, and that's a really central part of the story.
And final thoughts from you, Tom. I mean, what does this tell us about where the country is heading, and what can be done about it?
Well, it's, many people see Detroit as a canary in a coal mine. I don't see a wave of bankruptcies following, but I do see Detroit as symptomatic of what Jay talked about, which is a collapse in the sense of public responsibility in the United States. We treat cities like Detroit as responsible for their own fate. We say individuals are responsible for their own fate. We've lost a larger sense of commonality, of the common good, of responsibility. And as I look out into the future, I can only hope that the many civic experiments that are going on in Detroit and elsewhere will rekindle that sense of belongingness and broaden the sense of we from the narrow one that we have now.
Yeah, we'll have to get back to our Commons series and have you back, Jay, to talk about your book.
I'd love to.
What are your final thoughts? We have about 30 seconds.
Well, I think looking into my crystal ball here, I sort of see that what we think of as urban problems appearing more and more in suburban areas and even in rural areas. And in Chicago and in Cleveland, there has been some coalitions built around issues that have broken down some of the longstanding suburbs versus cities feuds. And so I see there more of that happening, and just people seeing that we have these kind of things in common. And certainly rural America has a lot of poverty as well, and a lot of disinvestment there. So that I think people in the end could come to see they have more in common with people in a town like Detroit than they really think. And that could be a change politically.
Jay Wall-Jasper is a senior fellow at the Project for Public Spaces. His new book is All That We Share, A Field Guide to the Commons. Thomas DeGruy is professor of history and sociology at the University of Pennsylvania. His latest book is The Origins of the Urban Crisis, Race and Inequality in Postwar Detroit. Thank you both for joining us. And thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. What are the legal ramifications of the most recent Supreme Court rulings on generic drugs? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about two recent decisions. One deals with brand name companies paying competitors to delay the introduction of cheaper versions of drugs. The second ruling shields manufacturers from liability for defective medicines. So what do the recent rulings mean for those of us who take generic drugs? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.